Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past. Suzanne Leal is the author of The Teacher's Secret, Border Street, and The Deceptions, for which she won the Nib People's Choice Prize and was shortlisted for the Darvet Awards and the Mark and Yvette Moran Nib Literary Award. Running with Ivan is her first foray into CYA fiction and was shortlisted for the 2023 ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category. It's a pleasure to welcome her to Imagining the Past.
Hi Greg, it's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Where did the first idea for Running with Ivan come from?
The idea came a long time ago, actually. It came when my first two children were very young, and I was we were out away at Coffs Harbour, and I just had this idea of a boy and what might happen to a contemporary boy if he were to travel in time. And it was just, I sort of took some notes down and then really sort of left it for years and years and years. So it was something that had been percolating in my head, but hadn't really come to fruition.
So what changed? What made you go back to the idea?
You know what happened? I was I'd handed a manuscript in, an adult manuscript, or at least in a fiction manuscript for adults, and my publisher at Allen and Unwin had spent some time looking at it, and while I was waiting, I needed something to do. I mean, it's a nerve-wracking time, as you might know, when you're waiting to see what's going to happen with your manuscript. So what's best for me is just to get onto something else rather than sitting around trying to work out what's happening and whether it'll be rejected, whether it'll be loved. And it was during COVID as well, so it was, you know, that really rocky time where we were in lockdown and out of lockdown. And I thought back to the story that that I'd thought of all those years ago, and I hadn't really tried my hand at writing for kids. And I think during COVID, a lot of people tried new things. Because we had more time, everything else was in flux. It was like you could experiment with something that you hadn't done before. And perhaps that's what gave me the confidence to start writing Running with Ivan and to try and find a voice that would work for kids.
So maybe just give us a quick summary of the novel, but also then lead into what kind of research you did to, establish the novel.
So thanks, Greg. The novel is the story of Leo Reilly, who's 13 when we meet him and 13 when we leave him again. He's an only child whose mother died a couple of years ago, so it's just been Leo and his dad, until Leo's dad remarries and he marries a woman called Julia, who has two boys of her own, whose names are Troy and Cooper. Now, Julia's a really nice woman, and Leo warms to her. He doesn't warm to her sons, though, Troy and Cooper, who have been through their own upheaval in terms of their family life. Their parents have divorced. And the story is really my exploration of how a child like Leo adapts to such a different living circumstance. The historical interest comes in because Leo suddenly finds that he can time travel, and he time travels to pre-Europe, and he time travels to pre-war Europe, where he meets a boy called Ivan. And from there, the book explores their friendship and the measures they take in order to save those around them as the war progresses.
And the research for the 1940s section, how did that come about?
So when I grew up in Wollongong, and when I moved to Sydney for university, at first I lived close to the uni, and then later on my then partner and I moved out to the beaches, and we got a good deal when we rented the place because we were right next door to the landlords. So it was like a duplex. One side, we were on the other, which, could be a little bit close for comfort, but I became very close to both Fred and Eva, who, as it turned out, were Holocaust survivors who were Czech. And in fact, Fred and I became so close that he agreed to tell me his story after I'd been living there for some years. It's interesting, I think, when you interview someone who's been through something as horrific as the Holocaust, because often it's someone at a slight remove, so not a very close relative, who can get the more detailed story. There's something about being just a little bit removed from something so difficult.
Well, it's Ovid the poet looking back at Rome, isn't it, from exile. You can see clearly when you're on the outside of something. When you're in something, it's harder to see it clearly.
I think that's right. And I also think that the relationship often between Holocaust survivors and their children is one of protection, of not wanting to upset them too much, of not knowing where to start, or of trying to live a life beyond the Holocaust itself. So Fred and I sat down, and I took his story over about a course of a year. And the story was an interesting one because I had little knowledge about the Czech situation. And what particularly interested me was the early time in the war for him, when he was interned in a ghetto called Theresienstadt, which was just outside of Prague. It's an interesting place, which I visited afterwards, or at least after we'd finished our interviews. And it's a camp, an internment camp, but unlike Auschwitz and some of the other more notorious concentration camps, it wasn't a death camp. So the...
It was also used for a lot of propaganda, wasn't it? Really early on, it was being kind of constructed almost as a holiday camp, really.
Well, I mean, that's how it was advertised. So it was advertised to Jewish people as a retirement village, as a beautiful place to go, and a lot of people actually paid to be sent there. When they got there, it was a fortress, and it was overcrowded. The food was poor. But the people who were taken there, predominantly Jewish and often very educated and very qualified, which meant that because they got to some extent manage themselves, with overseeing by the Czech gendarmes and Nazi soldiers, they got to use their skills to make life in the ghetto slightly more manageable. So you had engineers who could deal with the sewage system, and you had directors and singers and musicians who managed entertainment. You had builders and carpenters. And that led to a ghetto being a much better place than, for example, the Warsaw ghetto. And so much so that, as you said, the Germans were encouraged to make it like a show ghetto, and in fact invited the Red Cross to come and see the ghetto as a way of showing that conditions for Jewish people in the German Reich, because of course Czechoslovakia was part of that at the time, were actually quite manageable. So, and I thought that was when I wanted to write a book for children which discussed or explained the Holocaust to some extent, I thought that setting it in a ghetto was more gentle than setting it in the death camps themselves. And I think it's important for kids to learn about history, to learn about the war, and particularly the Holocaust. But I think it can be done a little bit gently. And that was the reason that I thought that the ghetto was a good place to set it.
So what year was it that you transcribed these stories?
Well, it was so early. It was 2002 or three, I think.
So this is amazing that you had taken these stories down with no immediate use for them beyond recording the stories. And then, you know, 20 whatever years later, they came to be part of a novel. That's quite unique. I mean, authors are normally working on quicker circles than that, quicker.
Well, look, I must say, I do have to credit Fred with my probably whole writing career, because I did write an earlier novel. So my first novel, Border Street, was the story of a tenant and her landlord and the friendship that develops between them. And that's, as often with debut novels, was semi-autobiographical. And what I wanted to do with that book was to examine the expectations I had of Fred. So he was a very clever man. He had a photographic memory. He'd made a new life in Australia. He was a bit cranky. He was racist to some extent. And I found myself quite upset by that. And I found myself expecting much more of him because he'd been through such an extraordinary circumstance, having gone through the Holocaust and then through the communist time in Czechoslovakia. And my expectations for him were much greater than they were for, say, my grandmother, who'd had a much more internationally ordinary life, if domestically, perhaps not all that easy. And it was that I wanted to look at. I wanted to think, well, why am I expecting extraordinary things from a man who started off hoping for an ordinary, if privileged, life, found himself in extraordinary circumstances, and then at the end really just wanted to have a normal life? And yet I just thought sometimes the expectations we have of victims like this are maybe too big. And that was what influenced the writing of that book. So
yeah, I've encountered a similar thing with someone who had escaped Hungary. And, you know, I guess what you're saying is true. I had these expectations, and then when present day situations were happening in Australia and some of his views on that, I found quite confronting, really, and I just had to put them down. I just thought, I can't, you know, I there's no point in me arguing these things with you.
And that's what I thought too. I thought, listen, how would I have behaved in such a situation? So that was it as well. It was sort of, you're taking someone's story as you've done as well. And what I kept on thinking was, first of all, why am I expecting so much of him? Why do I put so much pressure on someone who's already had so much pressure put on him? And secondly, how would I have behaved in his position? Who would I have been?
Yeah, they're interesting points. Yeah.
I think, and it keeps you going, I think, in terms of the writing. So you don't get
bored. With these interviews you did, I'm just kind of always interested in how they were done, because like oral histories are, you know, a very privileged thing for us as writers. When I wrote a novel that was set in 1860s Paris, you know, to have actually been able to speak to someone would have made the whole tour a lot easier. But so did you actually tape the interviews and then transcribe them, or?
Yeah, look, it's amazing thinking back on it. Just to digress for 1 minute to explain how I did it. There was a neighbour of mine a couple of years ago who had a fantastic story, And I thought, okay, when I get my some time, I'm going to take your story down. I'm just going to go and do it. And I assumed that it was in my court and that it was just depending on what time I had, because he had more time than me. And then he died unexpectedly.
Sure.
And as a result of that, I thought, okay, when I find a story, because stories, you know, come to you, I can't afford to put them off. I just need to do it, and I need to do it straight away. So when I was in an op shop, which I love, a couple of a few months ago now, I spoke to the man who was volunteering there. He was an elderly man, quite small, witty. And I said, oh, hello, how are you? And he said, I'm really bored. I'm really bored. And I thought, well, that's an unusual entrance to a shop.
Yes.
And I got talking to him, and it turned out that he was born in a concentration camp in Siberia and had come to Australia via boat when he was 13. And something sparked in me, because I thought, well, that's quite interesting, because that's a post-war story, and that's an immigration story of someone who's carried the Holocaust with him, but then moved beyond it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to interview him if he wants to be interviewed, which he did. So I go to the op shop once a week and interview him for an hour. The good thing about that is, with a smartphone, all you need to do is turn it on, let it go, and then when I finish and we have a cup of tea at the op shop, or he goes and serves customers, there's more than one person there, I use an app called Vomo. I just found a startup app, and it transcribes it straight away, perhaps not well, but it's all done. And then I send it to myself and I park it until I've got time to do more.
Hey.
Now, if we compare that to my work with Fred in 2001 or two, or whenever it was, I was working at the Legal Aid Commission. I had been working at the Legal Aid Commission, and I used to dictate some of my work with those, you know, those tiny little cassettes. Sound like someone from the Stone Age now. And so I took a dictaphone home with some of bought some of these tapes. And so I'd lay the dictaphone on the table between us, and Fred and I would just go to the local leagues club to interview. Press that, they would be, I think, half an hour each side, or maybe an hour each side, and then change it when it ran out. Then I'd go home and I'd borrowed from Legal Aid a transcription machine where you had pedals. It was like
pedals,
a sewing.
Yeah.
But, so I think you had, you must have had earphones and then pedals, so you could slow it down or speed it up. Mm. And I would, took me hours and hours and hours, like hundreds of hours. I mean, the good thing was you got a real feel for his voice. He had quite a distinctive accent and quite a distinctive manner of speaking, which I hope that in my first book, at least, I was able to copy. But it's just a godsend now how quickly it can be done.
Yeah. What have you done with that transcription, though? Is that being lodged in an archive or something? Because when I used to write, like, it was always dull to find those kinds of things.
That's a good idea, actually. You know, what I've done is the deal for Fred was that he would give me a story and I would transcribe it and he would have a copy of the transcript. So he had that, and then I've stayed friends with his daughters, and a few years ago I gave it to them and they said that it was just invaluable. I haven't thought about that publicly, because I mean, I've got it on digital, and I've got it printed, and it's quite detailed. It's about 500 pages, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I think that information, not even the direct information of a story, but just the detail of, you know, I'm sure he spoke about bits of life, you know, and what's just how people lived, you know, how they made a cup of tea or went shopping or whatever, and things, just that's the stuff that's priceless, I think.
Oh, I should thank you. I'll add that to the list. one other thing, interesting thing I've got is that he was quite wealthy. His parents were quite wealthy, and he had a whole lot of money and jewellery that his father had lodged in a Swiss bank account, or in a Swiss safe, and that was confiscated by the Germans. And he later sued the Swiss bank for having allowed that to happen. And I've got all the documents, all the legal documents.
Wow.
So,
yes.
That might also be, yes, good point. I'll look into
so
that.
So Running with Ivan's your first foray into CYA, as you have kind of suggested. I'm just wondering what, besides COVID, what tempted you into doing that, and why did you write historical CYA rather than, you know, perhaps a present day CYA? And also, what age group do you think it's aimed at? Because CYA is such a broad category, really.
Yeah, look, when I've spoken to kids at schools, I've spoken in groups of between year 5 and year 8, and I think the younger kids get something different from the book, and the older kids I can explain a bit more clearly about the war issue. So the older kids, so the year 7 to year 8, are particularly interested in the war, and I think the year 5 and 6 like the idea of time travel and a child making his way in the world. So why I made it historical?
Not so much that, but what attracted you to writing an historical piece?
I think because I had that story, and because I think for writing kids' books, there needs to be a time in which the kids are their own masters, and they, to an extent, run their own lives. So if the parents are there, they're at a distance. And obviously Harry Potter is an excellent example of that. And what had interested me is that Fred had been, when he was in the ghetto of Theresienstadt, he'd been, part of his work was to look after kids who were in a dormitory there. So rather than being lodged with families, a lot of the children were in a building which was separated into a number of rooms of dormitories. And it occurred to me that that was actually a really good way into a story for children, because it's the boarding school story, and they're by themselves. They have to work. They have to make a new life. There's danger, but there's also adventure. And I think that's the thing for kids, even when you're faced with such a difficult situation as the ghetto, you have to make your own life. And even if you're hungry, there are times in which there'll be adventure. And there was and I think perhaps the hook came when I did research about what some of the children were employed to do in the ghetto, and they would be runners. So because the ghetto was quite large, like it was a town, a small fortress town, and transport was foot or pulling a cart, not with animals but with people, they would get children to run envelopes and run parcels from one ghetto to the other. And that, I thought, would make a good story for a friendship between boys who were running together, and also would allow you to get a feel for the ghetto itself. And I think, look, I just think the Second World War never becomes irrelevant. It's one of those events where life was so difficult, where people had to manage such deprivation, that it is always a exploration of the mettle of someone, of resilience, of what they can manage and how they might go through. And so for that reason, I think it's always contemporary.
I think I was in grade 3. I'd been away sick for a period, and when I came back, everyone was talking about Hitler, and I had no idea what this was. So I'm just wondering, when you kind of first heard about, you know, the Second World War and the Holocaust, and what kind of impact that had on you.
It must have been the Diary of Anne Frank, I think, or other novels. I was a big reader as a child. And of course, you know, the great thing about when, you know, we grew up was that there was less to compete with. So
I remember the bookmobile that used to come to school. Like, yeah. It was a bus that had, it was a library on wheels.
Yes, exactly. And the book clubs and being read aloud at school. And that the Diary of Anne Frank was instrumental, I think, to me in because I know.
So what age were you when you read that?
I must have been younger. I reckon I was probably about 10, maybe 10. Could that be right? And there's also, there's a couple of other books that I read. I Am David. And look, there was a number of war books that I found. And look, I was never particularly interested in, you know, the dynamics of war itself or the war games or war rules, but it was always about how a child generally would run their way through it. I think what was most confronting, though, was when I was an adult, and I studied French and German at university, and I went to Germany to study for 6 months. And while I was there, I made friends with a Bavarian family, and the father was older than the mother, and he'd been in Hungary, and he'd been part of the German army, perhaps even the German Air Force. And I didn't really ask him about it at the time, although I did notice that he still had admiration for Adolf Hitler's economic reforms. So whilst he didn't discuss the human rights abuses and the deaths, he was interested in the Volkswagen cars, VWs, and yeah. and the other infrastructure that he thought Hitler had done well. And that was, you know, that was confronting, of course.
I remember a similar thing when I was living in Italy, and I asked my landlady if a letter had come for me, and she said, "Who knows, with the Italian post." And then she rested for 2 seconds and said, "It was better when we had Mussolini."
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, and that's what's so interesting for a writer, that these things that we see as history and these things that we see as long ago are actually quite close, or can be quite close.
And again, I think that goes back to what we have as a kind of almost a privilege living, growing up in Australia, is that we're on the outside and we're looking back at this event. And I think there's a potential for clarity that comes with that.
I think that's right. And I think what disconcerted me most was when I was with this family who I loved. I mean, I was very close to them. They were very good to me. We were watching television. Remember when you watch TV and you just got what you got and you didn't get upset, or you get what you get? So we just turned it on, and there was a film on, and it was the fictionalization, I think, or at least a film of the Nuremberg trials, which included a lot of coverage of the camps on their liberation. And I was there with this German family, and I felt acutely uncomfortable because suddenly I was the representative of the Allies and they were the representative of the Germans. And no one could turn it off, obviously, because that would draw attention to the dynamic we had. And so we just watched it. And I think that I had studied German for a number of years, and we really didn't focus on anything to do with the war. I think it was a time still where German academics were not comfortable with it, and so we'd go back to earlier like Goethe and Hesse, and really avoid the war situation. So I think what was interesting for me was to have this balance, or this lack of balance, between the Germany I knew and the Germany that I started to understand when I moved to Bondi or to Tamarama and was surrounded by not a German community per se, but a Jewish community.
So, I mean, writing about something as horrendous as the Holocaust for CYA, there's a lot of inherent problems, I think, in doing that. So how did you kind of overcome some of these problems?
Yeah, look, I got advice from friends and writers and experts in the Jewish community as to what might be appropriate to include in such a book, particularly as I'm not Jewish myself. So I was very I was keen to hear from Jewish experts themselves. And one of the pieces of feedback that came back was drawing the problem of having a child time traveling into something that was as pivotal for the Jewish community as, say, a camp like Auschwitz. It was almost something spiritual, that this was a place that had been so awful that it couldn't be punctured by contemporary involvement. And I considered that and took that advice on board. And what ended up happening was that I, whilst I allude to the death camps and Auschwitz, I focused the novel itself more on the ghetto and the prelude to 1944. And I think that worked on a number of bases. First of all, it addressed the expert advice I've been given. And secondly, I think it makes the book primarily an adventure book rather than a book to tell children more about this awful time. Like, I don't like to be didactic. I don't like to draw moral conclusions particularly. What I like to do when I'm writing is just to say, well, look at this.
It's problematizing it.
I think that's right. And so I think by having it in a dormitory situation where you've got two boys who have some power to change the circumstances they find themselves in, I think it gives a more gentle but real but still accurate introduction to the Holocaust itself.
I mean, there's a lot of literature, particularly adult literature, flooding the market at present on the Holocaust. Like, it seems a bit of an overkill to me at the moment. But like, a lot of times I feel like Jewish people are reduced to people who just wear a yellow star. You know, there's no kind of interrogation of their culture, what makes them what makes that culture different, their religion different, and, you know, their race different. It just comes down to a yellow star. So I'm just wondering how you kind of dealt with that.
It's an interesting question. I suppose if I can just park that question and answer in a different way. What I find very interesting at the moment is contemporary Jewish literature. So when you've got Jewish authors who are writing not about the Holocaust, but in the shadow of that history. So there's a fabulous book by Natasha Scholl called Found Wanting about her, it's a memoir about her exploration through the loss of a fiancé and her brother. And whilst the Holocaust is not at the forefront of the book, there's a shadow of it and there's a context for it. And that's what I think has been very interesting in the last 40 years, 50 years, that how the Jewish community has managed to acknowledge it, the Holocaust, and acknowledge the effect it's had on the generations, but also explore other things. So also explore, you know, grief generally, marriage, life. And for me, being not Jewish, the war has been of particular interest because I always wonder who I might have been during that time. So, you know, if you could put yourself there, or, you know, it's random how who we become. And I'm a German speaker. Would I have been a German who was privileged? Would I have been a brave German? Would I have been a cowardly one? If I'd been born Jewish, what would have happened to me? Would resilience have helped me, or would it not? Would decisions I made have made any difference to the outcome? So I think rather than me seeing it as a Jewish Yellow Star story, it was more a circumstance of how do people manage catastrophes and crises, and what can we take from it?
So the modern section is not really defined where it is, I don't think. I mean, forgive me if I missed it, but I didn't get a sense of what city the modern thing was happening in. So what was the purpose of keeping that so loose? Why did you do that?
Funny, isn't it? A lot of my fellow writers, and I'm thinking more about adult fiction at this stage, place their books very clearly in a particular street, in a particular suburb. I like to escape when I read, and in a way, by keeping a setting a little bit unclear, each reader can make it their own. So in my book, The Teacher's Secret, it's set in a small town called Brindle, which geographically really is close to is where I live. And I live in a sort of quite a small seaside suburb. By not naming it, I received a whole lot of feedback from readers saying, I know that you've set this in the Northern Beaches, or yeah, this horse is in the South Coast, or always Australia. And I think that's the same with Running with Ivan. There's a real Australian feel about the book and the setting and the climate. But I do like to give the reader their own playground. And I think by not naming a town, but by describing it well enough that you could place yourself there, I think it gives the reader more scope and more a sense of ownership of the story, I think.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Maybe I just like to be pinned down or put in a place.
Ironically, for a historical fiction, I do place it very clearly. So you know, you've got the contemporary part where you've got the time, you can imagine where it might be, but by the time you go back to the past, like you say, you pin yourself. I've got a poor sense of directions. I may have just been making it easy for myself.
Just a few kind of crafty questions, which I know our listeners are interested in, the how-to thing, listening for writing. So tell us about your first draft. Do you plan it out, or do you just kind of wing it as you're going?
So I know the ending. I always know where I'm going to end. And
goodness, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I always know what's going to happen in the end. The thinking is there any, I don't think there's any exception to that so far. I know where it will end. I'm just not quite sure how to get there. So I can start, I can have a beginning, not necessarily the beginning, but a beginning. And I know what the last scene will be. And I need to bridge the gap. To do that, I use a software package called Scrivener, which I'm familiar with as well, which I find useful because it's so visual. So you've got a sidebar, which you can divide into scenes and characters and settings and research. And then you've got the working screen itself. So why that's helpful, I think, is that I can divide, because you can divide everything into separate scenes, when one's not working, you can start another one. And visually you can see that. So, you know, for example, the manuscript I'm working on now, I've got maybe 30 chapters. And if chapter 5's not going particularly well, I've got notes on the document for chapter 17, which will enable me to jump there. So I suppose I plan, I don't plot meticulously, and I don't necessarily work chronologically, but I do have a skeleton.
Yeah. So you have, yeah, a skeleton, but you allow some organic development as you're going along.
Yeah, and look, I really hate doing the first draft. Really, 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 really hate it.
Yeah.
That's like pulling teeth. So when I've got a big fat mass of stuff that I can then start to refine, that's when I'm at my happiest.
Yeah, I agree. Like, that's when you can start kneading what you've done. Yeah.
Creating it.
Oh, it's blood on your temples, basically. So how many, when you're doing that first draft, how many words do you aim for in a session? Do you have that kind of, do you do that?
When I first create, I just do it more timing. If I can do something like 1,500 words in a session, that's great. But I tend to put on that Pomodoro clock and then just work for 60 minutes, take a break, work for 60 minutes. A good day would be, and depending on my other commitments, when I could do a solid 3 hours work. And that's for creating, because creating is hard. And when I'm editing, then I can work longer because it's less, doesn't rip your guts out as much.
I agree. It's enjoyable. It's where it comes to life for me.
Playing with words. I mean, when you get the right word, that's a feeling of achievement, I think.
Do you jump back and forth, though, from I think a lot of writers, sometimes when they're still on a first draft, they might get to a point where they can't see the way forward, so they go back to the beginning and do a bit of work on that. I'd find that quite difficult because it's like changing gear completely. Like, it's a completely different set of concerns. So do you finish a complete full first draft before you start revising, or do you jump back and forth?
It's like being an unfit bushwalker. Like, so I keep on going, but I'll stop, and some parts I don't do as well. So, you know, if I do want to progress it, so I want to go forward. I don't want to go back, but sometimes I just can't make myself fill in the scene. So I'll write bridge, and I'll write, and then I'll just put something in capitals about what I need to do. Which is great at the time, but then it's bad when you come back when you think you're finished and you've got the scenes that just say to do.
I mean, you're kind of unique in terms of that you've written both adult and CYA, and I just kind of, you must have been writing Running with Ivan and The Watchful Wife at pretty much the same time. So it kind of reminded me of that country and western song, I Became Schizophrenic So I Could Love You Twice as Much. So what do you find the differences are between those two writing styles?
I can be more provocative when I write for adults. So I push the envelope further when I'm writing for adults. And I think if I were to define myself in terms of a theme, I would say that I write about moral complexities. And that's something that you can do in books for children as well. But I think I probably do it more gently and slightly more subtly. Whereas in my adult books, I think that we're living in a time where there's an inclination to be very binary. So you're either right or wrong, you're left or you're right, you're on or you're off. And to me, fiction, particularly for adults, allows you to inhabit a middle ground where things are grey. So, you know, for example, with the watchful wife, I'd read an article by a writer, sort of an activist writer, who quoted the dictum, in the revolution there's going to be collateral damage. And it was said better than that, but basically it's, you know, if you want to progress society, you've just got to accept that there'll be collateral damage. And that's why I wrote The Watchful Wife and thought, okay, well, let's explore what this collateral damage might be. Is it too much? Is it not enough? Is it what we just have to accept? So that's what the adult, and you can really push it there, and you can really bring your readers with you, who might not otherwise have gone with you. So if you just push a scenario, push it further, 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 and then the reader might well be surprised by what they're thinking. And I think that's in this time of cancelling and people being very vocal about very rigid thoughts, I think that's, for me, the place of my adult fiction. I think for children, for the writing for children, I mean, it's similar. You're talking about, for me, it's putting children in a position that's not easy and seeing what they do with it. So for Leo, it's how do you get used to a family that you didn't really want to be part of? And then when he goes back in time, it's how do you understand what's happening and what control do you have when the world's gone mad? But it's sort of gentle. And I think, too, what's fun about the kids' stuff is that you need adventure. I've got three boys, and this Running with Ivan is predominantly about boys, although there's women, girl characters too, particularly Linda. But the fun thing about children's books is trying to keep the momentum and keep a sense of adventure.
Well, something I was going to ask you about was that it is very male orientated, which was refreshing, to be honest. I'm just wondering around some of your decisions around that, because they seem to run, you know, most people who read are female, so a lot of books, the subjects are about women's struggles or female struggles. So I was kind of interested in what your decisions were around that.
I think it's probably easy enough that I have three boys. I have one girl who's now 12, 13, so that might reflect new work where I explore that age and girls more. But I don't think it's necessarily an easy time to be a boy or a young man. And I think that there's been an admirable and important emphasis on girls and how girls can progress. But I've always worked, I've always had boys. I've been a mother of boys for many years before I had a girl. I worked at the Legal Aid Commission where my clients were men. So, you know, I had a very close relationship with my father. I've always gravitated towards men and how they might struggle to express themselves. And I think that includes itself with boys. And I think there are young boys who find themselves in difficult circumstances and are unable to express themselves. And I wanted. I also understand it, that girls will read boy characters, but boys are less inclined to read girls. And I like boys. I like talking. I like boys and girls, but I like talking to boys at school. I like the funny thoughts that fill their heads, and I like the adventure that I could manage with boys. Obviously, you can do it with girls as well. But look, write what you know, and I know boys.
So you were shortlisted with Running with Ivan for the 2023 ARA Historical Novel Prize, the CYA category, obviously. I'm just wondering what that kind of prize and the nomination meant for you.
It's so terrific. I mean, it's the best thing, really. You know, I try not to get too smug about it because I think these competitions are difficult to make shortlists from and to find winners, and that there's a wealth of Australian literature. But you know, when your number does come up, it's fabulous. So what I'm new to the young adult and children's area, and to be shortlisted in such a prestigious competition gives me confidence to keep going. It also gives me a feeling of belonging in this community, and the community of children's authors has been very welcoming and very supportive. I think it just gives me the confidence to think I'm on the right track, and there's nothing like some recognition to get the creative juices going again, yeah. Keep writing. I think it's not an easy, I mean, you would know, it's not an easy or financially rewarding career to decide upon. And it's things like praise from readers and public recognition that really boosts you enough to keep going on what is often a precarious route.
So what are you working on now, and does that include another CYA?
It does. So I'm just, in fact, it's due very, very soon. And I think I'm just about good, I think. It's another children's book, so it's for middle grade readers again. Not time travel, historical fiction, and this time it's set in France.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time today. We've covered a large amount of information. I hope it's been interesting for listeners.
Oh, look, it's been terrific for me, and thank you so much, Greg, for taking the time to talk to me and for asking such probing and challenging questions. I very much...
My mother always said I was exacting, so...
Exacting is good. I think we need exacting.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many illuminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.